Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, with you every Saturday afternoon here on News Talk 580 KMJ and online at kmjnow.com. If you're a Fresno State Bulldog fan, you know that the Bulldogs are in action tonight in Logan, Utah. So this week's program was actually pre-recorded with a gentleman who today is celebrating his 65th wedding anniversary. We're going to hear a little bit of that story with Jesse Dudley of Santa Rosa, California, 88 years old, but sounds pretty sharp to me. And we're going to hear some incredible stories, stories about generals and emperors and time in the skies during World War II. Mr. Dudley, thanks for joining me this afternoon. Tell me, with your love for aviation, is that something that was born early as a boy growing up in Texas, or is that something you stumbled upon in the armed services?
What was the question again now?
As far as your love for flying, because obviously you've spent a lot of time, a whole career in aviation, whether it be a military or civilian. Is that something that from the time you were a small boy you wanted to do?
No. It, as a matter of fact, the attack on Pearl Harbor got me thinking about getting into the military, and at that time, aviation cadet was available, and I couldn't think of anything better than that, so I signed up for aviation cadet.
And at the time, you were in Sweetwater, Texas, do I have that right?
No, I was in Baytown, Texas. I was going to school.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, after they called me, October 92, to go to San Antonio for pre-flight. And I went to San Antonio for pre-flight. From there, I went to Sweetwater for primary training.
All right, I got that mixed up there. I apologize. So in October of 42, you were doing your pre-flight. But take me back, if you can, to December of 1941 and that Sunday morning that changed the world in a very real way. What do you remember about how you learned that the Japanese had attacked Pearl Harbor? Is that something that's still pretty clear in your mind?
Well, yes, I learned over the radio. And, of course, I was going to junior college at the time in Baytown, Texas. And I went on to school. And during the week, I went to Houston and signed up for aviation cadet.
And little did you know at that time that you'd spend a pretty good chunk of your life on the island of Oahu where that attack happened.
Oh, yes, I did. Yeah.
I bet at that point you'd never heard of Pearl Harbor, huh?
Never had until then.
So you decided to enlist the very next day.
Yes.
And aviation cadet sounded good to you, but just because you want to be an aviation cadet doesn't mean you're going to make it through all the cuts and all the clearances. How many people from your class of cadets actually made it through to pilot training and became pilots?
That's right. Yes. After San Antonio and pre-flight, I went to Sweetwater, Texas for primary training.
Mm-hmm.
And this one instructor had four pilots to train. And out of that four, I was the only one that made it through class or through to graduation. And I was very proud of that. But
probably made you a little lonely, too.
Yeah, I love flying. I just, you know, after the first flight, the instructor took us up and tried to make us sick and did everything in the book to make me sick. But I lived through it, and I love flying and went right on through.
So at that point, I'm guessing you expected to be flying a bomber crew somewhere? Is that what your expectation was?
That's correct, yes.
But as is usually the case, and I hear from so many veterans, what the veteran expected and what the government ended up expecting of the veteran were two completely different things. And they had an interesting assignment for you. Tell us how you came to be the personal pilot for General Mickey Moore.
Well, I was on the island of Oahu up at Wheeler Field with a bomber crew. And they offered us a photo training, which we took instead of being a bomber, because there wasn't any place in the Pacific to go for a bomber at that point. So we took the photo five, and we sat there. We mapped the island, I don't know how many times, but anyhow, we got tired of that, and I heard that General Moore was looking for a crew for his Cardenas, and I talked to my crew, and we all decided that we'd sign up for it, and that meant that just myself and the co-pilot, the flight engineer, and the navigator would go to the general. The rest of the crew was offered assignment in Guam for active bombing. And that's what happened. I signed up with General Moore, and he accepted my crew. We moved down to Hickam and got an old version of the B-24, which is LB-30, a French airplane, because it was a cargo plane.
Mm-hmm.
But in all aspects, it was like a B-24, except it didn't have supercharged engines. It just had two-stage engines. But other than that, it was a B-24. And I stayed at Hickam, or the crew stayed at Hickam for quite some time before February of 45, and that's where Mickey Moore's headquarters was. I was assigned as the flight operations for the command, and I got all the airplanes I could get my hands on assigned to us so that the fighter pilots could fly them. And in doing so, I ended up flying most of them myself.
Well, that must have been fun.
That was fun. A lot of fun.
Now, something tells me, and you're flying a modified B-24. I've talked to pilots of just about every military aircraft that America had in World War II. And normally what I hear from the guys who flew B-24s was that they loved the airplane because it was durable and they knew it would bring them home. It was had a lot of protection. But it sounds like it could be a real chore to fly. You had to be very strong to get it in the air, to keep it in the air. And it seems like the bombardment abilities it had was really its main function for the actual combat B-24. Was it ever a bear for you to fly, especially knowing that it didn't have that armament that most of them had?
No. You know, I had fully intended to have armament and doing bombing runs just like the rest of them, but at that point, I guess they really didn't need us over in Europe and send us out to the Pacific. And the only active 24s in the Pacific was at Guam. And that's how I ended up finally with General. And, of course, that was good duty.
Well, and you would have some very interesting flights. It just occurs to me, you've heard the different nicknames that all these planes have been given over the years, and one of the ones that the B-24 was affectionately given was the Flying Anvil, and I guess when you have no guns and bombs, it really is a flying anvil.
Oh, yeah. It is.
But it didn't come crashing to the ground when you were at the controls.
Yes.
As far as the other planes that you had the privilege to fly because of your unique position there as the operations officer, was there another plane that you just really loved being in, a P-38 or something more maneuverable? Was there one that once you got a taste of, you kind of wished you would have been able to fly more?
P-38.
Yeah?
Yeah, the P-38 was a beautiful airplane.
What about it did you enjoy as someone who didn't usually have the luxury of flying it?
The particular one I had been an air evac airplane, so it had pods on the wing to put patients in. And I enjoyed flying people around. Just, you know, they'd never been up in a P-38, seen the islands from that viewpoint, and it was really a nice airplane. Of course, the P-47 was a good one, too. I enjoyed the 47, but it was a heavy, heavy airplane. So.
And I understand, well, obviously, a lot of guys, when they think about maneuverability and speed and a pilot's airplane, they think of the P-51. I understand you almost got a chance to fly a P-51, but the general wouldn't let you? What's the story there?
Well, we had one assigned to my operations, of course, because Fighter Command all had checked out in P-51s at that point, and I was getting ready to to take off and try it out. And he got word of it, and he said, "No, that's too fast for you four-engine pilots." He said, "I don't want you flying the P-51.
I bet you would have given him anything to take that thing off and prove him wrong, but it wouldn't have been worth it.
I sure would have, yes. Yeah, but we were getting ready to go down to Iwo Jima at that point, and I didn't see any need to fight it, so I just ignored it.
Well, obviously something worked out all right for you, because you're here talking with me today. 65 years of marriage, and the military had something to do with you meeting your bride as well. You mentioned Iwo Jima. I'm going to ask you about that. I also want to hear about your duty in ferrying the Emperor of Japan around. We'll get to all of that, but right now we need to take our first commercial break. Jesse Dudley, 88 years old, of Santa Rosa, California, our guest today. This is Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Frontline of freedom. You are listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. My guest today, 88 years old, retired pilot, both in the U.S. Army Air Corps, later the Air Force, and also Hawaiian Airlines, and some very interesting duties throughout a long career in aviation for Jesse Dudley, who's celebrating his 65th wedding anniversary today, September 18th of 2010. That means he met his wife back in, or married his wife back in September of 1945. But he met her because of good old Uncle Sam sending him to Hawaii. Tough assignment, I know. And we heard a few of his stories. We're going to get to many more. We're going to hear what he experienced at Iwo Jima above the island as he flew with General Moore. We're going to also hear how he ended up being selected to fly Emperor Hirohito and the Empress later on, many years after the war. But right now, let's get a little finer detail on some of these circumstances, because you shared a little bit, Mr. Dudley, and maybe it's my questions that weren't targeted enough, but you shared a little bit about some of the airplanes you got to fly because of your unique position as an operations officer under General Moore. You had the ability to go out and procure airplanes and take them up and make sure they would be good enough to fly the general around in. And you said you got to fly a P-38, that was a lot of fun, but we didn't get into the story of how you came to fly a P-38. You were hanging out at a bar with some Navy pilots. Do I have that straight?
Yes.
And how did you trick them into giving you that airplane?
Well, they told me they had one for sale. As a matter of fact, they checked me out in it first. I flew it the next day, and I was very happy with it. And they said, "Well, you can have it if you want to buy it." And that's when I told them that I'd have to check back with the general. But the general approved it right away, and we ended up with a P-38.
You know, I've talked to some pilots who said just being able to go up and fly every day was like someone gave them $1 million, because they had these expensive toys that they got to take up. And granted, they had a very difficult job to do, as did you. But here you are with a general right above you, and you get to have the ability to go out and buy an airplane. That must have been quite the privilege and quite the treat for you.
It was. It was, yes.
And I'm sure you never abused that privilege, right?
That kind of finagling, turned out pretty good in the service with Hawaiian Airlines, but we'll talk about that later.
We will talk about that with Hawaiian Airlines. Speaking of Hawaii, why don't you tell us when you first said aloha, meaning hello, not goodbye, to your beautiful bride who you're celebrating 65 years of marriage with today. You met her in Hawaii, right?
I met her at Hickam Air Force Base. She was in supply. And, of course, we're flying back and forth with the general. I was in supply. As a matter of fact, in Iwo Jima, he felt he needed a bathroom, and I had to get him a whole bathroom set. And, of course, Nettie, my wife, was very helpful to me in those negotiations. And so flying back and forth from Iwo, I met her and had a few dates, but she wouldn't marry me until after the war was over.
I'm sure that must have been an interesting conversation. She thought your work was too dangerous, or what?
Yes. Being in the military, she thought was too dangerous. But it worked out fine. War was over in August, and I married her in September. So.
Well, she was just waiting for you to prove it to her that you could make it all the way through the war.
I guess so, yes.
And prove it to her, you would. And, you know, that those are the stories that always strike me because, you know, myself and I, people who've heard me speak know that I say this a lot, that I wouldn't be here if my grandfather hadn't made it home from Europe in World War II. I would have never been born. Obviously, you wouldn't have met your wife if you weren't where you were because of the Army Air Corps. How many kids and grandkids wouldn't be here if that all didn't happen the way it did?
Well, you know, she had a lot of boyfriends at that point because, I think it was one girl to every 100 men. So I think she was kind of playing the field a little bit, too, you know, telling me about being...
and she's not on the line to defend herself here.
No. So
you had some competition, but you must have done something to win that competition.
Yeah, well, we went night swimming at Waikiki and over in Kaneohe, and, you know, we had a good time. And it continued on until after the war was over and got married.
Well, and 65 years later, you are still married. And one of the products of that, your daughter Barbara, is the one who filled me in about your exploits. So I appreciate
That's
her doing
right.
that.
Yes.
A lot of times it's the children or stepchildren or in-laws of veterans that tell me some of these stories. A lot of you wouldn't tell me yourself, so I'm thankful for that. But I appreciate your candor so far today. And let's talk about something that I think our listeners will be very intrigued with. You mentioned the words earlier, Iwo Jima. Now, when people picture Iwo Jima, they think of the Marines on the ground. They think of that sight of the flag, either one of the flags, going up atop Mount Suribachi. They don't often think about the bombardment of that island or the role that that the Air Corps played in the Iwo Jima situation. What did you see? How long after the initial invasion did you show up there with the general, and what was the purpose of your flight?
In the Iwo Jima, is that what you...
Exactly. Tell me about how you ended up there.
Well, I was going to navigate all the P-51s down to Iwo Jima from Hickam.
Mm-hmm.
And so we started off, we hopped from Hickam to Johnson Island to Kwajalein to Aniwetok to Saipan and then on into Iwo Jima. And we landed there at T+3. And, of course, the Japanese were still fighting the Marines. And we got their attention when I landed with the B-24. I guess they hadn't seen one that close up before. But the 51s all landed ahead of me. And we had a very uneventful flight. It took a few days to get there, but... No problems whatsoever.
No problems whatsoever, but from what I hear, there were actually bullets flying across the runway when you put that B-24 down.
Absolutely, yes, it sure was.
Well, you got to question your definition of uneventful here.
I think they were awed by the sight of the airplane, and they just looked like they were kind of standing there with their jaws hanging. And, of course, I didn't stay very long. The runway was kind of short and temporary, and I ran off the end of it with the B-24, but it was nice and solid. It wasn't sand like most of the island. And made a quick turnaround and got back up to safety.
So you ran off the end of the runway. You said that very matter-of-factly. That sounds like that could be potentially hairy to me.
Well, it was it was mostly hard-packed dirt or whatever it was, I don't recall, but anyhow, I was a little surprised too that made a quick turnaround right there off the end of the runway and back. All the 51s had landed safely ahead of me, so.
Well, I think it's safe to say it's probably a lot easier to land a P-51 there than a B-24.
Absolutely, yes, absolutely.
And I'm sure you were focused on getting to that makeshift runway. And, of course, people that know the history of the Pacific War know that the strategic importance of Iwo Jima was to provide a runway where the big bombers could take off and bomb Japan, and that eventually proved to be true. But that was not what was the situation then, only 3 days into the battle. It was by no means secure. I'm sure you're focused on just getting that plane down and accomplishing your mission, but as you were flying in, did you see anything that sticks with you today as far as the scene you were looking at and what was happening on that small volcanic island?
Suribachi. That was going to be home to me. We had our headquarters and our living quarters right at the base of Suribachi, which was still in the hands of the Japanese. And it wasn't secured for quite some time after we got there. And, of course, they had booby traps all over the island, like new lumber stacked up. And if you had tried to take it, it would have blown up, you know, things like that.
So how long did you actually stay on Iwo Jima?
Till the end of the war, yeah.
I didn't realize you were there for that long. So you and the general landed there, and he needed to be there to oversee the P-51 missions?
Yes. Oh, yeah. Yes. And as a matter of fact, he tried to get me to stay there after the war was over, and they were all leaving. He offered me a promotion and everything else to try to get me to stay, and I would not. I wanted to get back to my wife and on the island of Oahu.
Yeah, because she wouldn't marry you unless you got back.
That's right. That's right.
Well, so you were there just 3 days after that invasion started, and that's about how long the military expected it to last, but it lasted a lot longer than that.
It sure did, yes. Yes, the Marines were quite surprised on the landing, yes.
Well, and I imagine you saw quite a bit, even though your duties were not the same as what the Marines were doing. You probably experienced and witnessed some pretty vivid experiences there.
Oh, yes, yes. We could see Suribachi. It was right outside our tent. And as a matter of fact, we were also worried about nighttime. We were trying to dig under our cots, but the sand was so... I can't think of the word. In other words, it kept filling up the hole that we were digging.
Mm-hmm.
And we did have some of our pilots that were killed during the night. The Japanese sneaked into the tent and slit their throats. So it was quite discomforting to live there.
Well, and in addition to stuff like that, which that's the very definition of making it hard for you to sleep at night when guys are getting killed in their sleep pretty close by, there's snipers everywhere, I imagine?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you mentioned booby traps. I'm sure you saw some results of some of those booby traps.
Yes, I did. Mm-hmm. Yes.
What kinds of things did you see? Explosions? People dying?
Yes. Uh-huh. Yeah. I was there when they ran the Japanese out of the tunnels with the fire, you know,
the flamethrowers.
Flamethrowers, yes. So, you know, I was quite close to it. And we'd walk along the beach. There was a beach area, and bodies floating in from all the activity that happened on D1, so...
Was that difficult? It's a stupid question to say, was that difficult? Because anybody listening can see that it was. But I guess maybe the question is, how difficult was it just to do what you had to do each day in a scene like that? And maybe when you see all the Marines doing what they're doing and you know that your duties are different, you probably want to do something. And there's not that much that you can do, I imagine.
That's absolutely right, yes. There's nothing you can.
How did you deal with that? Was there something that got you through day by day, something you thought about or focused on that helped you keep going?
Well, they had their supply of cold beer, you know, and that helped some.
That would certainly do it, I suppose, especially on a hot island.
Oh, yeah.
In the Pacific. Well, I guess the question then is, with Iwo Jima, and I'm sure there are many more stories you could tell us about what you witnessed there, and anyone who's familiar with the brutality of that battle can imagine that, but when it was winding down, I guess, first of all, when the island became secure, I imagine that was a pretty good day for you and a day to celebrate?
Absolutely, yes. Sure was.
And then were you still there when the Japanese surrendered?
Yes. Yes, I was.
What kind of scene was that when that word spread around Iwo Jima?
Well, it was really a celebration, I'll tell you.
Well, I can't imagine what it must have been like, and I know there are many more stories that you still have to tell us. We're going to take another break right now, but when we come back, we'll move on from Iwo Jima. We'll move on, perhaps even from World War II, and hear about some of the very interesting experiences that Jesse Dudley had after World War II and his long career in aviation. Jesse Dudley of Santa Rosa, our guest today. It's Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Now, more Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Jesse Dudley, 88 years old, of Santa Rosa, California, with us today. And today, September 18th, 2010, the day that he and his wife, Nettie, celebrate their 65th wedding anniversary. So it's a special day for the Dudley family, their extended family. Many of those family members wouldn't be here if he hadn't made it home from the war. You've heard about some of his experiences in the Army Air Corps, flying a variety of planes, and most regularly a B-24 that was outfitted a little differently because of the special job he had of ferrying around General Mickey Moore. And I didn't ask you, Mr. Dudley, and I should have, what kind of guy the general was. I think people have an opinion about generals in general, for lack of a better term. And that perception maybe isn't always accurate. When you're as close to someone as you were, I bet you got to see a real personal and human side of General Mickey Moore.
He was very down-to-earth, friendly. I never saw or heard of any outrages or anything like that. And he was always very fair to me, very friendly. And one thing that I forgot to mention about him was that after things settled down on Iwo for a while, he wanted an airplane to fly around the other islands with. And I suggested that maybe I should get him a B-25. And he said, yeah, that's great. So I went back to Oahu and found a B-25 that had a single pilot seat because it had a 75 cannon in the right seat during the war. And I bought that for him, took it back down to Iwo Jima on the same way to Johnson, Kwajalein, and Wheaton, Saipan. And he loved it. He loved the B-25.
Well, and of course, the B-25 had gotten things started for the U.S. and the Pacific a long time before that. So it's fitting that once it was all said and done, that's what you were taking him around in.
Yeah, and I'm reading that book right now, and it's a great book.
About the Doolittle Raid?
Yes.
You know, you'd mentioned before the break about being at Iwo Jima from 3 days into that battle, right, through the end of the war, so a period of several months, and yes, you know, so many Americans died there, so many were wounded there, so many were buried there.
That's very true.
What, was it emotional for you when you left that island, knowing that everything that had been sacrificed on that soil for the cause of freedom?
Temporarily it was, but I was looking forward to getting married and that sort of thing, and it kind of went by pretty fast.
Yeah, I bet you couldn't get home fast enough.
That's right.
And she had told you she wouldn't marry you unless you came back, so you probably were in a hurry to get back and see if you had any competition back
right
there in Hawaii.
Absolutely.
What, do you still remember the moment that you made it back and you saw her again?
Oh, yes, yes.
Tell me about that.
Well, I couldn't hold my emotions back. I was so happy. But we dated for a while after that, even before getting married, and it was really the highlight of my life, getting married to Nettie. And, of course, we're celebrating our 65th, and it's been a wonderful life.
Well, and there are some more adventures that you had that you haven't even told us about yet, right. And you would actually end up back on Iwo Jima. Of course, you didn't know it then.
Yeah.
But after you came home, you were in the reserve.
Yes.
You worked as an air traffic controller. Then you got hired by Hawaiian Airlines.
That's correct.
But then Uncle Sam called you again for the Korean War.
That's right, yes.
And you had a very interesting duty in that war. You weren't carrying a general around this time, but wounded soldiers, is that right?
Wounded soldiers, yes. From Japan back to Hickam, some of them on to San Francisco, depending on how serious they were.
And the Air Corps never did trust you with guns, I guess, because this was an unarmed transport plane, a big C-54?
Right, and I carried a sidearm all the time, but I never shot it once except in practice.
Uh-huh. And your planes were never armed.
No, never.
That duty of ferrying wounded soldiers, I've talked to a few pilots who've had that privilege, and it seems like everyone that I've talked to has a story or at least a general sense of what it meant to see these men, some without limbs, you know, severely wounded, and seeing what they're willing to give up for their country. Was that something that struck you on an emotional level, and is there something that you recall still today about the soldiers that you brought home?
Yes, it was very, very emotional for me. But, of course, we had nurses on board to take care of the wounded, and really never had any bad incidents. Anybody, you know, trying to take over the airplane or anything like that. So I enjoyed it.
And I don't want to put words in your mouth, but when you saw them in the situation that they were in, did it make you feel thankful that you had not only survived World War II unscathed, but obviously we're in a good situation in the Korean War too? Did that make you more thankful for your own situation to see what could have happened to you?
Sure did, and even till today, I'm very thankful for that.
So you served in World War II and the Korean War, and then after that, you left the military as a captain and got back into Hawaiian Airlines, and little did you know, you would end up carrying a pretty important passenger once upon a time. How did that come about with the Emperor of Japan?
At the time, I was chief pilot at Hawaiian Airlines. And the CEO said that we were having a very important visitor and wanted me to fly them around the islands. And so I did. I took the emperor and the empress to Kauai, and they spent a few days there, and then they wanted to go on to Hilo, and that was fine. So they had carte blanche to go where they wanted, and I took them where they wanted to go.
Did the irony there ever occur to you as far as what the mission that you and your fellow airmen had in World War II was, and now who you were taking around?
No. By that time, I kind of admired the old guy. I thought you know, he did what he had to do. I'm sure he was told to do it. I don't think he made the decision himself. But, no, I kind of felt sorry for him.
Mm-hmm. What made you more nervous? Flying General Moore around when people are shooting at you, or flying the Emperor of Japan around 20 years later?
I think flying the Emperor around impressed me more. It's hard to explain in words. Seeing this elderly, he was old to me at that time, but he was very placid, very agreeable to everything. He wasn't a Tojo or that type of thing.
Mm-hmm. He certainly didn't seem militant or adversarial to you.
No, absolutely not. No, he was very placid.
Well, and he gave you something that I understand you still have.
That's right. He gave you a pair of gold cufflinks with the Emperor's insignia on it, yes.
Well, that's some pretty good proof in the pudding right there.
That's right. Really, really is.
And that makes me wonder, other than your bride, who you met in Hawaii in World War II, and you've already told us that was the best day of your life, seeing her again.
Right.
You have those cufflinks from the Emperor long after the war, but is there anything that you held on to that reminds you of your time in the service during the war?
Got a lot of orders.
Well, I'm sure some of those are pretty interesting.
Yeah. No, I don't, except a couple of models of airplanes that I flew.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you have plenty of memories that you've been sharing with us this afternoon. We're going to take our final break of the program, and when we come back, we'll hear more from Jesse Dudley. It's been our privilege to have him on today, 88 years old, from Santa Rosa, California. And we'll hear the rest of his story when Hometown Heroes continues next on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Now, more Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
I couldn't go the whole show without playing Wild Blue Yonder for our guest today, Jesse Dudley, 88 years old, a World War II veteran, served in the U.S. Army Air Corps, flew again in Korea when he ferried wounded soldiers back home to the States, and kept flying 35 years with Hawaiian Airlines. You've heard him talk about some of the time he spent in the sky carrying around some pretty important passengers like General Mickey Moore during World War II, later Emperor Hirohito in the 1960s. Some pretty interesting experiences. I guess the one question I haven't asked you, Mr. Dudley, is if you kept track of this, how many flight hours do you have?
A little over 21,000.
Is that all?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, maybe if we find a P-51 you can fly, you can add to that.
Well, I had to retire when I was age 60.
Did you ever think about that after the chance you thought you might have to fly a P-51 and flying all those other aircraft after your time in the service? Did you ever think, boy, it'd be fun to fly one of those sometime?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It would have been at age 60. At age 88, I wouldn't want to try it.
Yeah, you wouldn't want to have to pay the insurance for that.
No,
huh?
That's right.
Well, I'm just wondering, you know, one of our listeners might call up and give you a chance to fly the P-51, but you're saying you'd have to take a pass on that?
I think so, yes.
When's the last time you were in the cockpit?
1982. I retired in August 30th, 1982.
So it's been a while, but I understand that the family legacy continues with Hawaiian Airlines because, and I mentioned earlier, you know, if you hadn't come home from the war, hadn't married your wife, your children wouldn't have been born, and a lot of these things would be a little different, and I guess Hawaiian Airlines today would be down a pilot, too.
Yeah, that's right. Mike is enjoying his life as a pilot. So.
I bet that makes you proud to see your son carrying on your legacy with that company.
It does. You know, he started as a baggage boy, and he was working as a baggage boy when I hired him as a pilot. So...
You know, and I don't want to turn the show into a commercial for Hawaiian Airlines, but I think we can talk about this for a minute because it's something that I didn't know, and I think probably a lot of our listeners didn't know either. But, for instance, on September 11th, 2001, Hawaiian Airlines, in the aftermath, flew military people as well as New York City firefighters and policemen to Hawaii for free to give them some R&R?
Yes, yes.
And they've been doing that kind of thing for a long time.
Oh, yeah. Hawaii's been very good about that.
Did you ever have some assignments like that?
No. My assignments were all inter-island.
Mm-hmm.
They started the overseas or away from Hawaii several months after I retired.
Gotcha. You must have done a lot of island hopping there. You've probably seen every square inch of island in the Hawaii chain.
That's correct.
From a bird's eye view.
Yes, that's right.
So do you have any tips you want to share with our listeners for maybe the spot that isn't necessarily crowded with tourists or isn't what we always hear about but was one of your favorite places to go?
Well, like the Emperor, I've always loved Kauai and that area there.
Mm-hmm. Little still still more pristine than some of the more developed areas.
Correct, yes.
When you look back at 21,000 hours in the sky and certainly what you endured in World War II, especially those months on Iwo Jima, which was nowhere near secure when you got there, what are you most thankful for? Are there any days where you stop and say, wow, I am pretty fortunate to be where I am? And is there something that you look back on and you're most thankful for making it through?
Yes. 85 years with my wife. I mean, 65 years with my wife.
Well, that would do it.
Yes.
Is there anything you can tell us about the guys that you served with? And obviously, you had a very unique duty. There weren't too many B-24 pilots who got to do what you did. And there were some responsibilities, certainly, that came along with that. But when you think about the guys that you served with and the people that you saw and the sacrifice you saw all around you, and you think about today's young people and what they may or may not know about that time in our history, is there one thing that you would try to get across to them to explain what happened during World War II, what the mindset of young Americans like yourself was, and why you all did what you did?
Yes. Dedication. Dedication is the word I'd like to use. We saw a need for our services, and we did them as well as we could.
So, you know, when you, on the day after the Pearl Harbor attacks, went and signed up, I think that's something that a lot of people around the country did, and we saw that again after September 11th, where a lot of young men in this area and all over the country did similar things. And a lot of people would say, hey, you want to think about that a little longer. Don't be in such a hurry to put yourself in that situation. When you look back on that today, are you glad you did what you did right after Pearl Harbor? Do you ever wonder if it would have been different if you made a different decision?
Yeah, it would have been different if I'd made a different decision. But I was in school, working on my second year of college, and I signed up. And of course, the military told me to continue my life, and they'd call me. Well, they didn't call me for 10 more months, and then I had to give up my college, and of course, I finished it in later years, but that was, that's the way it was in those days.
Well, and if I'm reading between the lines correctly, it sounds like you're pretty thankful for the way things worked out.
Absolutely.
We just got a couple minutes left in the show, and I'm curious. You've shared a lot of stories with us, and you've had some very interesting experiences. Not many people can claim to have flown around a general and an emperor, and I know you enjoyed flying around just regular Joes throughout your time in the sky. But is there anything from your time in the service that's maybe a lighthearted story, something funny that you saw or experienced that kind of lightened up the mood in a situation that it wasn't easy to have a smile on your face?
No. Well, I had a co-pilot that was that played the guitar.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, I think my wife fell for him before she did me, but she still talks about him.
Even after 65 years,
yeah,
huh?
That's right. Yeah.
So he would play his guitar and had the ladies swooning for him?
Oh, yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Well, how'd you elbow him out of the way?
He was my co-pilot.
So you just pulled rank.
Yes.
That's the way to do it. Well, Mr. Dudley, we're just about out of time, but I so appreciate you coming on with us today and sharing some of your experiences from your time in the military. Thank you for serving our country and for being willing to talk about it. Is there anything else that you'd like to share with our audience today?
Well, you know, I did have another experience that you might enjoy, and that was with Hawaiian Airlines. I was flying an airplane to Italy, to Rome. We sold it to the Italians.
Mm-hmm.
And as I landed and pulled up to the ramp, this tank pulled up with a 38 cannon sticking through the window, and they swarmed on the airplane to check it out. I'm sure they must have been curious about if I was carrying something else, you know, something in the airplane.
So that got your attention a little bit, huh?
That got my attention, yes.
You weren't even greeted that harshly at Iwo Jima.
No. No, I wasn't.
Well, I know there are probably many more stories that we didn't have the time to hear from you today, but it's been a pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much, as I said, for serving our country, and happy anniversary.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you for being so kind to me and so patient.
Well, the pleasure's been all mine, and I think our audience would say the same thing. That's Jesse Dudley, our guest today. If you know the Dudleys, wish them a happy anniversary today, 65 years. That's the program. We'll be back next week with another edition of Hometown Heroes here on News Talk 580 KMJ.